It's Thursday, December 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a planned ceasefire in Syria quickly fails.
The question is whether the president should be indebted to large banks.
Conflict of interest questions swirl about President-elect Trump. Also ahead, U.S. interest rates are on the move, and a movie of turbulent times for a former first lady. It's all on today's International Edition. A plan to evacuate civilians and rebels from Aleppo, Syria was delayed, and a ceasefire in the battered city broke down with the resumption of fighting in the last remaining rebel-held areas. Russia blamed opposition fighters for breaking the truce by attacking Syrian government positions. But Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said it was government forces who attacked first. Russia backs Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, but Turkey supports rebels who want to oust him. Dr. Kalasawa is the CEO of the U.S. branch of the relief group Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations. She tells International Edition host Sarah Williams what is known about the situation of the remaining civilians trapped in Aleppo.
I mean, imagine you have about, I know it's between 80 and less than 100,000 people that are trapped now in few kilometers. They're saying between, I think, around 2 kilometers. But so let's say a few kilometers, they're trapped in an area that are being heavily bombed at this point. Basically, they're waiting for the moment of death. And there's no swift action that is occurring. And the negotiation was actually choosing a resolution. They came to a resolution between two crimes against humanity, either to, destroy the whole city on the top of the people, and they are in there, or to force evacuate them off the city just to save their lives, but also to force them out of their own homes. And even the second resolution that they came about last night has not been applied.
Do you know, is it clear why the evacuation did not take place? I believe the various countries are accusing the other of being responsible.
Yes. I mean, there have been a lot of accusations. However, you will definitely hear different reports because, you have different parties involved and every party wants to make sure that they're getting it out in the way they are involved.
Is there any kind of medical treatment left there in Aleppo?
Oh, that's a really tough question. Actually, if there is, it's going to be very scarce. We know that the doctors there are really struggling with the few medical supplies that they have left with them. Trying to work in a little bit safer areas. And I heard one of the doctors was saying, of course, I cannot disclose names, that we won't leave until we make sure that the people leave safely. Because if people need us inside here, we want to make sure there's a doctor that could respond to their call. Situation is beyond imagination.
And I'm sure the people left have anything.
Nothing at all. No. I mean, it's total besieged. They have been under total besiege for over 100 days. So if they had any at one point, now it's the situation. You know, what we're hearing right now is basically, the people are trapped in a small, very small area. Imagine you have 100,000 people and they very few kilometers of area with scarce food, probably scarce medications, if there's any left, and no fuel, no electricity, no clean water. I don't know how to describe it, but I could just say that they are keeping those people just to face the moment of death, basically, if it's going to continue like that, and they don't find a resolution within the next 24 hours or so.
I don't know what any of the chances would be if any kind of resolution could be found at this point.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, it is very much a lot of political sides are involved, and it's really hard when you have many parties are involved to get a resolution. And really, we as humanitarian actors, we cannot resolve issues like that. It is basically this is the responsibility of the international community, and they need to take action before even it's too late. I mean, it's already too late, but even further to be late to keep those people just to die there and no action taken.
Dr. Kalasawa, the CEO of the U.S. branch of the relief group Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations. Coming up on International Edition, we'll be talking about the economy and looking in depth about a move by the U.S. Central Bank to raise interest rates. And, you know, it's not every day that the central bank and its chairwoman, Janet Yellen, are the talk of social media. Today happens to be one of those days. Michael Lippin is with us to explain.
It is the day today. That's right, Jim. It's that day because the Fed, as our listeners will hear later in the show, raised its key interest rate by 0.25% today. It's only the second rate increase in 8 years. Now, economics professor at the University of Michigan, Justin Wolfers, put this into perspective on his Twitter feed, which has more than 100,000 followers. Justin Wolfers tweeted that my daughter is now 7 years old, and she's never seen the Fed set interest rates as high as 1%. It's been that long. And he also tweeted that the Fed raises its rates from super low to merely very low. Not much to argue about here, he says. It's still really, really cheap to borrow money in the U.S. So just to put things in perspective there. U.S. news site Politico also tweeted an article about how this rate increase could affect the incoming administration of Donald Trump. Its headline reads, Trump wants to light a rocket under the U.S. economy. Janet Yellen just started hiding some of the fuel. Now, in that article, Politico says the Fed sees a significant Trump stimulus coming in 2017 and is ready to pump the brakes if necessary. The Politico report says that will likely further unsettle a relationship that already saw the president-elect repeatedly criticize the central bank chairwoman on the campaign trail. Now, one Twitter user, Jason Stutman, who's a financial writer, he said, if you don't think that Yellen is raising rates now just because Obama is headed out of political office, you're kidding yourself. So he's implying that there is definitely a political motivation here because this won't hurt Barack Obama. He's only got a month left in office.
Mm-hmm. Well, some great comments there. And who would have thought the economy would be so much fun on social media?
That's right.
There was another Trump-related topic, getting attention on social media. What was that about?
Well, it was about Donald Trump's meeting with major U.S. tech company leaders in Trump Tower in New York. Now, Donald Trump's tech summit, as Facebook is calling it, was one of the top trends on Facebook today. He met with the CEOs of Apple, Alphabet, Facebook, Oracle. An ABC News article about that meeting got a lot of Facebook users commenting. A lot of critics of Trump were commenting there. One guy said, Trump is going to bully those tech leaders, and when that won't work, he'll bribe them, and more of our tax dollars will be going to corporate welfare. Hashtag Don the Con is a crook. But one supporter of Trump was saying, this guy Trump is working hard and early, you know, he's not taken office yet. Let's grind and get this money. Stop hating and let this whole thing play out. Back to you, Jim.
All right, great. Information from both sides. Thank you so much, Michael, for the analysis. You can follow him on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. I'm out there at VOA Stevenson. And of course, we always invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Among the stories that are trending in Asia, analysts see Trump comments on One China as part of a bigger game. China seen boosting defenses on artificial islands. Afghanistan continues to fume over Russia's outreach to Taliban. Philippine president admits to personally killing drug dealers. Rakhine violence testing limits of Aung San Suu Kyi leadership in Myanmar. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. And if you haven't already, try our mobile app. It's the VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. This week, President-elect Donald Trump postponed a highly anticipated announcement on how he'll deal with conflicts between his global businesses and his job as president. His financial investments are one concern, but his debts are another, including loans held by a German bank. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti looks at one big one, the U.S. Department of Justice investigations into his biggest lender, Germany's Deutsche Bank.
They are stately properties with prime addresses. Golf resorts, skyscrapers, all carry high mortgages for President-elect Donald Trump. These three properties are of particular concern to experts because of the bank that holds the loan. $364 million from Germany's Deutsche Bank. Former White House ethics attorney Richard Painter.
The question is whether the president should be indebted to large banks while he is supervising the people who are going to work out our posture toward bank regulation and also enforcement of the rules we already have, including the pending actions against Deutsche Bank.
One pending action is a U.S. Department of Justice investigation into Deutsche Bank's improper selling of mortgage securities before the 2008 financial crisis. Jan Baron, an expert on political law, says a conflict could be avoided if managed properly.
Cases over at the Department of Justice are handled by career professional prosecutors and attorneys who work at the Department of Justice, no matter who the president is. And there is no reason for any president to be involved in the matter.
Financial experts tell VOA total divestiture is nearly impossible. And it is also unclear how Trump might insulate himself from U.S. government actions involving Deutsche Bank. The Trump transition team declined to answer VOA's questions. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. central bank officials raised that key U.S. interest rate slightly Wednesday and said further increases will come at a gradual pace. Janet Yellen is the Federal Reserve chairman.
Our decision to raise rates should certainly be understood as a reflection of the confidence we have in the progress the economy has made and our judgment that that progress will continue, and the economy has proven to be remarkably resilient. So it is a vote of confidence in the economy. This was a decision that was well anticipated in markets, and I think it will have relatively small effect on market rates.
Economists say the U.S. job market and housing sector have largely recovered from the recession and no longer need as much help from lower interest rates. Experts say keeping interest rates too low for too long leaves the Fed without the tools it needs to bolster the economy when the next downturn hits. And it also raises the risk of sparking strong inflation that could hurt the economy. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us from New York with more.
This is the second rate hike in over a decade, just about 11 years, and it's unanimously decided that we're going to take it up another 0.25%, which was very well telegraphed. But I think what we're going to continue to see through 2016 is that Trump bump rally and remain on that uptrend, or at least remain at the levels that we are right now. One of the reasons is, why would you sell this year when you're going to get a better tax preferred rate next year? So I think that's going to be one of the reasons why we're going to stay where we are. You also have to remember that you have fund managers that are chasing performance that did not participate in the lows of this year since they were hedged. So now we're looking at big buy programs coming in the S&P 500, the tech-heavy NASDAQ, as they look to chase performance.
Well, a lot of big expectations for the coming year, certainly. And with an increase, there are certain areas of the market that tend to do well when rates go up, like the financials.
Yes. Absolutely, the financials. When interest rates go up, that improves the margins for banks. Better margins equal a healthier balance sheet. That's one sector I certainly want to keep an eye on. Technology is actually starting to turn around. What we've been seeing is sector rotation. And when we talk about sector rotation, that's money coming out of stocks that outperformed, going into underperforming sectors so you can capture some of that upside. But, Jim, what's interesting is that normally happens over the course of multiple quarters. We're seeing this in a 24-hour news cycle, for example. The consumer staples sector is a great example of that. One area that is underperforming a bit is the new real estate sector. We used to have 10 sectors in the S&P 500. We now have 11 as real estate was pulled from the financial sector, and that is, of course, because of interest rates. But, you know, the Fed said that they're expecting three more rate hikes in 2017. They said the same thing last year as well. So they have that flexibility. They're going to remain data dependent. But quite honestly, data has been quite strong, and we've seen that in consumer confidence numbers and manufacturing numbers.
It's a sign of a healthy economy, and it also gives the Fed some leverage in case something happens to the economy.
Right, that's true. It'll give them a chance to reevaluate their balance sheet. And again, if data keeps improving, I think we're also going to see improvement out of corporate America in terms of earnings. And if we ride this Trump rally through 2017 and we get that infrastructure spend, we get more friendly regulations towards companies trading on American soil, I think you'll continue to see improvement in, you know, manufacturing, industrial, financial sectors. That's going to be the key. And I don't think we're going to get any volatility till Trump's first 100 days, because that's when it's going to be show me time if his business-friendly theories are practically put to work.
Well, this sector rotation that we've been talking about is quite amazing.
Right, right. And, you know, some of the areas I like, I think tech is going to continue to be strong. Cybersecurity, of course, is a very popular topic out there. But quite honestly, tech is a cyclical sector, and it has been beaten up over the past few years. And I think we're coming back into that time where companies are going to be spending on their IT, cybersecurity in particular. I think you're going to continue to see expansion of data services centers. And so that's an area I would be looking at. The financials, of course, which have been probably one of the worst performing sectors since the financial crisis, and this could be their time to shine as well.
As the markets continue to swirl, our whirling dervish in all things financial is Jill Malandrino in New York. Jill, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And of course, the economy is one huge part of the incoming Trump administration, and it's very vital to economies around the world. Follow it all on our website at voanews.com, and be sure to check us out on Twitter at @VOA_IE. While you're online, we've got a Facebook page for you to visit. It's VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. In his psychological drama, Jackie, Chilean filmmaker Pablo Larraín paints an impressionistic portrait of First Lady Jackie Kennedy during the first days after her husband's assassination on November 22, 1963. The film relies on anecdotal stories, newspaper clippings, and archival footage, and it is a cinematic attempt to peel off Jackie's complex personality rather than to document JFK's assassination. VOA's Penelope Palou has more.
People like to believe in fairy tales.
And you?
I believe that the characters we read about on the page end up being more real than the men who stand beside us.
Filmmaker Pablo Larraín uses the tragedy to reveal Jackie's complexities. He reconstructs her different faces. The innocent debutante, the fashion icon, the wife, the mother, the artful White House decorator, and the widow behind her husband's legacy.
Well, there are many things that we know that we used from different sources, but there are a lot of things that we don't know, and we create them. And that this is why this is a movie, it's fiction, it's not a documentary.
Poetic license aside, Jackie scriptwriter Noah Oppenheim told VOA that he penned Jacqueline Kennedy's different personas based on archival material and his own memory of her.
I've been fascinated by Jackie Kennedy my whole life. My mother was a big admirer of her. She saved all the newspapers and magazines, and I used to look through them when I was a little kid. And I'm just a student of politics and American history, and I've just always admired her.
Mr. Valenti, would you mind getting a message to all our funeral guests when they land?
Of course.
Inform them that I will walk with Jack tomorrow.
Academy Award-winning Natalie Portman offers a tour de force performance as the enigmatic First Lady.
You obviously have to achieve for the way they talk, the way they move, the way they look, just to get people to believe you enough to get into the movie. And then, of course, emotionally, it's such an extreme experience that she went through that's almost impossible to relate to because, you know, you have grief in your life, you have tragedy, but this is on such an epic scale and such a worldwide stage that, you know, she's really probably the only person in history who's had this kind of experience. So to really sort of try and get into that mindset was very extreme.
I will not sneak out the back door. I will go out the usual way, we all will.
Pablo Larraín mixes Jackie's harrowing moments with flashbacks to happier days during the 2 years of her husband's presidency.
The movie, look, what it does, that shows like slices of memory, pieces of ideas. We all remember things throughout emotional things more than real facts, and these memories in the film are emotional memories, and not all of them make sense, not all of them are very connected, and that's why it feels real.
Each evening, from December to December, before you drift to sleep,
Jackie feels more like a psychological drama than a biopic. Jackie's flashbacks of Camelot, an idealized representation of President John F. Kennedy's administration, reveal happier moments, but also hint at a darker side of the couple's union, where infidelity and political pressures were varnished by style, opulence, and young ambition. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
For director Tracy Carter, engineer Mark Ferguson, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us and listening to International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Afghanistan continues to enjoy extraordinary support from the international community. This support was reinforced at the Warsaw Summit in July, where the United States and its NATO allies and partners agreed to sustain the Resolute Support mission beyond 2016 and to provide financial support for Afghan security forces through 2020. In October, at the Brussels Conference on Afghanistan, the United States and over 70 other countries pledged to continue development assistance through 2020. Earlier this month, representatives of Afghanistan and 13 other countries in the region met in Amritsar for the 6th annual Heart of Asia Conference. They were joined by over 20 other supporting organizations and countries, including the United States. Speaking for the United States, Acting Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, Laurel Miller, explained that while the support of the international community remains essential, what is just as important is the support and partnership of Afghanistan's neighbors. Establishing enduring security and self-sustaining economic development within Afghanistan requires a common regional effort. By the same token, security and economic progress in Afghanistan will benefit the entire region. The threat of terrorism remains a serious concern in Afghanistan and throughout the region, said Ms. Miller. In the second year since Afghan forces assumed full security responsibility for their country, they have performed admirably in combating a determined enemy, she said. In the coming year, it will be critical for the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces to continue improving their capabilities. It is also essential that the Afghan government continue to strive to create the conditions for a durable peace. An Afghan-led, Afghan-owned peace process is the surest way to end the conflict and bring stability to Afghanistan. The United States strongly supports such a process. We commend the Afghan government for concluding a peace agreement with Hizb-e-Islami and believe that successful implementation of the agreement can send an important message to other militant groups, said Ms. Miller. Ms. Miller also welcomed the Afghan government's recent appointment of new elections commissioners and the successful prosecution of officials for corruption. The security, political stability, and economic prosperity of Afghanistan and the region are inextricably intertwined. That's why the U.S. remains resolute in its support of stronger regional cooperation and economic integration as the way forward for Afghanistan and the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.